Canucks fans, and welcome into episode 113 of the Canucks Speakeasy Podcast. I'm Pete.
And I'm Doug.
Doug, it's the last game flight for a little while, so let's get into it.
The Canucks headed to the Calgary Flames and came away with a 6-3 loss. JT Miller had three assists in the loss, and Quinn Hughes had a goal and an assist.
Canucks complete the sweep of the Kraken in their inaugural year, winning all four games, this time 5-2 at home. Of note, three different defensemen scoring, which I don't think that's happened a lot. And also Quinn Hughes breaking the team record for most points and assists by a defenseman in a season.
The Canucks then hosted the LA Kings and came away with a 3-2 victory in overtime. Brock Besser had two goals, while Elias Pettersson had two assists.
And the Canucks, their last game of the season, fall 3-2 in Edmonton in the dreaded shootout in the sixth round. JT Miller and Connor Garland finished up strong months, each with scoring a goal. Another point in there for Quinn Hughes as well. And it's also worth noting, Spencer Martin remains without a regulation loss in a small sample size of games that we've seen. Doug, it's all over now, eh? The regular season is over, the playoffs are about to begin, and the Canucks are on the outside looking in again.
Yeah, I mean, I think you and I both predicted that we thought the Canucks would be a playoff team heading into this year. Unfortunately, they didn't make it. The other thing I think we also forgot to mention during that game flight, Pete, is that they wore the skate jersey in two of the last four games, which I thought was pretty cool. I'm guessing that was also after they were officially eliminated from the playoffs. So it was probably, you know, a smart play by ownership to try to get more fans in the building for those last couple of games. But I loved it. I know a lot of the fans on social media loved it. And let's bring back the skate jersey on a more regular basis next year.
There's been a lot of rumblings that the Canucks are planning to bring back the skate jersey in a larger capacity next year, if not a full-time capacity. So it is something to definitely keep an eye on, but I do think we're going to see the jersey more. And also, you know, I mentioned Spencer Martin in the game flight. Starting the last three games, I think Demko is just exhausted down the stretch. I've tweeted quite a bit about his workload and how it's something that was pretty unprecedented. I tweeted one tweet about how he's never played this many games in a season, and his mom liked it. And,
really?
I think that says something right there. I'm like, if I'm getting Danielle Demko liking a tweet like that, as like I think Thatcher was really tired. Great to see the Spencer Martin, and I really like the way he played. I think with all the questions surrounding this team going into next season, and we're not going to get too much into speculation because we're going to have 5 months of that, but goaltending is something that they're going to be going into next season with a pretty clear lock on who's the 1-2.
Yeah, and hopefully Spencer Martin can, you know, carry some of the load and play 25 to 30 games next year and give Demko a bit more rest. I also think Demko had a couple of nagging injuries throughout the course of the season. There were a couple of games in the last month, maybe month and a half, where he was getting up after, you know, making a stellar save, a little gingerly from here and there. So, yeah, I agree with you, Pete. You know, he's never played this many games, and I think to give Spencer Martin the net for the last few games was smart. They've already committed to Spencer Martin for next year anyways, but hey, let's get him some more NHL games, some more NHL playing time, so he's even that much more prepared next year when he's the backup to Demko.
Yeah, 100%. I agree with that. Also, we're recording this the day after the Canucks lost to the Oilers in the shootout. It's April 30th today. And I just wanted to mention how weird a night it was in hockey last night. There was just a lot of strange things happened, whether it was Arizona playing their last game at the Gila River Arena. That's a bit of a tongue twister. Their last ever game, down 4-0 to Nashville, end up winning at 5-4. The crowd there was something else. It's like, where has this been for Arizona games? They moved to that little barn down on the other side of the city next year. Malcolm Subban singing the anthem. I mean, that was something else as well. Chicago and Buffalo, the players just went crazy for that. That was, I thought, a pretty cool sight. We have another e-bug situation in Dallas or in Anaheim with the the guy playing in net for the Anaheim Ducks in the third period. The Habs score 10 against Florida. I mean, I know it wasn't like a major Florida team, but it's still Habs getting 10. Guy Lafleur's old number in the last game of the season. And then the whole tucked in with that, the NHLPA announces the Donald Fehr position change as well. I mean, it was a weird, weird night in hockey with a lot of other games not meaning anything. It was a weird night.
I mean, unfortunately, I missed the majority of that stuff, Pete, because I am actually back in Toronto. And I know the speculation is going to be rampant. Oh, Doug's back in Toronto to watch the Leafs playoff chances. And that's not the case. But yeah, I think it's really cool, actually, the Montreal Canadiens there scoring 10 goals their last regular season game. And obviously, like you mentioned, Guy Lafleur's number was number 10. That's kind of a cool little thing. And then it is interesting that the PA did change or reshuffle their kind of leadership at the top there, and Donald Fehr kind of moving into a different role or having a different title within the PA. I'm not sure when the current collective bargaining agreement comes up, but I'm guessing it's just posturing for the next round of negotiations, whenever that is.
It sounds like a lot of it had to do with the Kyle Beach incident. The players wanted a change with how that was handled. But more info will come out. It sounds like Fehr is staying on until a replacement is found, but I don't know if he's going to be involved with the PA after. But overall, it was a weird night. I thought the situations with the Dallas-Anaheim game with the e-bug, even the Dallas players coming up and congratulating him after he's in net for Anaheim, I thought that was pretty cool. And Malcolm Subban singing the anthem and the reaction on the benches, that's going to go down in as like a heritage moment in hockey right there. I thought that was pretty cool. Doug, we got a fun episode coming up, though, amidst all of this. We're going to be joined by Sheldon Lee, who's making his debut on this podcast as well. For those that follow him or don't follow him on Twitter, Sheldon G. Lee 1. Again, we got another rookie joining us, and excited to see what he can do for the lineup.
Yeah, I mean, anytime we could bring somebody on to the speakeasy and they're willing to spend 45 minutes to an hour talking hockey, Canucks hockey with us, I mean, it's always greatly appreciated from you and I. Yeah, I'm looking forward to the conversation with Sheldon, and I know he does some graveyards on the radio. So, you know, the fact that he's getting up after his graveyard shift from last night and willing to jump on the speakeasy with you and I, kudos to him. And also, this will be one of our last episodes for probably a few weeks. I know, Pete, you've got some vacation time planned. I've got some vacation time planned. So we'll probably be taking a break for, I would say, at least 2 weeks, maybe even three. And obviously, if something huge happens between now and then, which I don't think it will, because there's generally no major transactions throughout the course of the playoffs, I'm sure we could do an emergency pod. But yeah, this will be one of our last episodes for a while.
Yeah, we're going to take a couple weeks off, and then we will get into draft stuff, because the Canucks have a first rounder, likely picking 15th this year. So we'll be starting to take a look at that, starting to take a look at free agency and all the speculation. And there's going to be a lot to talk about this offseason. And geez, I think it's going to be a really entertaining offseason. You can follow us on Twitter as well. I'm at Pete_Gass, and the podcast is at Canucks Speak.
You can give me a follow on Twitter at Doug Venn, and check out our Spotify playlist. It's the Canucks Speakeasy outro playlist. Another funky jam will be getting added to the playlist at the end of this episode. And Pete, did you want to share with the listeners out there, talk a little bit about the track you picked for last week's episode?
Yeah, I kind of went with a little bit of a different vein from what we always do. And a band like The Clash are certainly a band that crosses over a lot of different genres. And they certainly, you know, they're punk, they're rock, they're dub, they're ska. They've got their hands in a lot of different things. And their beats have been sampled a lot as well. So there's kind of a connection to the more kind of like theme that we have going with our playlist. But I kind of went backwards with getting to this. I've been listening to a lot of Santigold recently again. And Santigold, when I get into that, I kind of start listening to, you know, other people in that same vein a bit, like MIA and Doja Cat, and like all these kind of people who kind of in that sort of mix. And MIA has that one song that samples Straight to Hell by The Clash. And it was just in my head. And then I went, I was just like listening to The Clash. I came home one night, just put The Clash on. And when I went to decide what I wanted to use for the outro, that was the first song I had when I opened my phone. I'm like, Let's do it. Let's chuck in Straight to Hell by The Clash. From the album Combat Rock, a little bit all over the place, that album. But a couple of other big hits of theirs were on that one, too. So, yeah, a little bit of The Clash. Get The Clash in the mix there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, legendary, you know, punk band. I mean, obviously there's reggae influence, ska influence, some punk influence, and rock. And they are one of those bands that definitely is able to kind of transcend genres. And, you know, for musicians like you mentioned MIA, you know, sampling them, and Santigold sampling them, you know, their music does actually transfer over to like hip hop and R&B music quite well when sampled correctly and very good. And yeah, man, I actually really liked the track. I love the MIA track as well, but I do love Straight to Hell. I think it's one of their more underrated songs. Even a lot of people didn't realize MIA sampled a Clash. They didn't even realize it's a Clash song. So I think that's really cool as well. And yeah, man, I mean, I think the playlist, people could say what they want about that playlist. I think the majority of people really enjoy it. But, you know, it is definitely all over the map. Like, it's got a general basic theme to it, but it's all over the map. And I think that's what makes the playlist work in a lot of ways, because nothing stands out too much. It's not like we've got like a thrash metal song, you know, following up like a Tribe Called Quest song or anything like that. Not saying that that couldn't work, but no, I thought throwing in The Clash there, Pete, was a really nice choice.
Yeah, I think the playlist has its own life now. We kind of know what would work in it. Like, I put it on shuffle at work, and you're right. Like, I mean, you know, having a Slayer track or something coming on in there, Metallica or something in the middle, would disrupt the whole playlist. So we definitely got kind of a vibe, but the vibe can grow out a bit. And again, The Clash crosses a lot of different genres and different types, and it certainly sneaks into what we're doing as well with that playlist. Doug, before we get Sheldon on, there's a couple things we got to do. We got to do our 3 stars of the month, and then we're going to do kind of a very abbreviated around the room and just do our first round playoff predictions now that the series are set. So, Doug, let us start off with the 3 stars of the month for April.
I think he'll be back for an encore yet tonight. Fans haven't left. They're still here. And still the 3-star selections to come.
All right, so I'll go first. My 3rd star of the month for the Vancouver Canucks is Vasily Podkolzin. I thought Podkolzin had a very strong final month of the season. He played 13 games, came away with 4 goals, 5 assists for a total of 9 points. But honestly, it was just his two-way play. The fact that he was out there near the end of games trying to hold the lead. I thought Podkolzin was definitely one of the better Canucks this past month, and he's why he's my 3rd star of the month. My 2nd star of the month, it's got to be JT Miller. I mean, JT Miller played 13 games. He had 18 points. He only had 4 goals for the month of April. He had 14 assists, though. And again, you know, JT has been the engine for the majority, if not the entire season, that has drove this offense for the team. And yeah, JT Miller is my 2nd star for the month of April for the Canucks. And my 1st star, I don't think this is any surprise. I would hazard to guess you're going to have the same 1st star, Pete, and that's Elias Pettersson. Petey's played 13 games, had 19 points, 10 goals, 9 assists. He was absolutely dominant all month. And, you know, we saw flashes of Petey from a couple of years ago, which was nice. And it looks like he's only getting better. And I look forward to a full healthy season, off-season training for him, and seeing, hopefully, for him to have a solid start heading into next season.
Nice stuff. My 3rd star, JT Miller. For all the reasons you said, he led the team in assists this month as well, but also just how he finished. The most points in a season for a Canuck player from North America. He beat Todd Bertuzzi's 98 points by 1, hitting 99. So I wanted to get him in there. Similar for my 2nd star, giving it to Quinn Hughes, who 15 points in 11 games. He missed a couple of games this month. But just again, finishing with breaking a team record for points in a season by a Canucks defenseman and assists in a season. I thought that was worthy of recognition. Number one, yeah, no doubt about it, Elias Pettersson, 10 goals in 13 games. Eight of those goals were even strength as well, led the team with 19 points. Petey was the easy choice for the first star. Love that you got Pod Colson in there. I was looking at Pod Colson. His play was very, very noticeable this month. And also honorable mention to Connor Garland, third on the team in scoring for the month of April, but isn't able to sneak into either one of our three stars. 16 points in 13 games. I thought it was Connor Garland's best month as a Canuck, as well as Vasily Podkolzin, as well as Elias Pettersson. I think all three of those guys had their best months ever as a Canuck, and very much warrants some recognition. But it is also a testament to how the team played down the stretch. I mean, even down towards the bottom, Horvat had 8 points in six games. Besser was a point-a-game player in the eight games he played. Alex Chiasson was second on the team in goals for the month. He had six in the 11 games. So it was a solid ending for the team as a whole. Tough to really kind of leave some of those guys out, but that's just the way it goes, and it's nice to have those problems. So just to recap, Doug gives it to Podkolzin, Miller, and Petey. I give it to Miller, Hughes, and Petey. And Doug, let's get into our abbreviated around the room section here to talk some playoffs.
I think you're going to want to hear this.
No, I'm just playing. I'm having fun here at the hockey game.
All right, let's start in the East. You're in your new hometown of Toronto, so let's start with that series. Let's start with Leafs and Lightning. Doug, who you got?
I mean, I got to say this first. I mean, Toronto couldn't have had a worse first-round matchup than the two-time back-to-back defending Stanley Cup champions, Tampa Bay Lightning. I know the Lightning, I mean, again, they've been good this year, but they haven't been dominant like they have been the last couple of years. And I'm not saying this because, you know, I'm a newfound Leaf fan, but I do think the Leafs pull it off. I do think this is the year that they actually get past the first round and they will beat the Tampa Bay Lightning.
I'm going the other way. I'm saying Tampa Bay just because of Andrei Vasilevsky. I think come the playoffs, he's often the best player out there. I do think in a way it's good for Toronto to be facing these guys, because if they can get through Tampa, they're going to have as good a shot as anyone getting out of the East. But yeah, your reward for having like your best season in franchise history is to play the two-time defending Stanley Cup champions. That is tough. I don't have a lot of faith in Toronto's back end and goaltending still, but I do have a lot of faith in Vasilevsky and the way Victor Hedman and the Tampa D can play. So I'm giving Tampa the nod on this one. Florida versus Washington. Doug, who you got?
I actually think this series will be quite a bit closer than most people might initially think, but I've got the Florida Panthers winning this one. I think they added, obviously, Claude Giroux at the trade deadline, and I mean the season that Huberto had and the season that Barkov had, Bobrovsky, you know, finally looks like he's earning at least a portion of that $10 million a year salary he got signed to by the Florida Panthers. So yeah, for me, I think Florida, they're younger, they're quicker, and I think they come away with the victor against the Washington Capitals in that series.
Yeah, I'm Florida as well. You know, Washington, hey, good team, but Florida really is next level right now. Huberto having a lights out year. Barkov, again, having a great year. They are deep. They score a lot. Washington plays a run and gun as well. I think there could be a lot of goals in this series, but if you're playing run and gun with Florida, you're likely going to end up losing. So I'm giving that one to Florida as well. Boston, Carolina, who you got?
I think this one's pretty easy in my opinion. I've got the Carolina Hurricanes. I really like the Carolina Hurricanes, not only in this series, but in the East in general. I think top to bottom, they've got speed, they've got decent size, they've got a really deep blue line, and Freddie Anderson is a good goalie. I know he's been injured the last few years, but I do actually really like Freddie Anderson as a goalie, and again, maybe that's my Leafs bias showing again, but I think Carolina comes away with the series victory against the Boston Bruins in this one. Pete?
This one I've gone back and forth with a bit. I don't actually trust Carolina's goaltending that much. I think they do have a good blue line. They're getting a lot of help from the blue line. I really don't know. I think this one, regardless, is going to go the distance. But something in my gut is telling me that the Bruins might be ready for an upset here. So I'm going to take the Bruins. I just think that line, their top line, could get going. And I don't know. There's just something with Carolina kind of a little bit slow down the stretch. And, I mean, that could just be an anomaly. And they are a great team, but I'm gonna take Boston in this one, I think. But it's going to be close. I think that one's going to go seven. And Pittsburgh Rangers, I think this is going to be another close one. What do you think?
Yeah, I think this will be close too, but I actually think the young and upcoming Rangers, especially with Shishkin and Net, I think they actually come away with the victory here. The Penguins are aging quite fast. I know Crosby is still very productive. Malkin, when he's healthy, which he hasn't really been healthy the last few years, is still a productive player. Same with the defenseman. I can't think of his name right now. Help me out, Pete.
Letang,
thank you. But I don't trust Pittsburgh's goaltending. Jari's been okay, but he's not been solid, and so I do think the Rangers. I mean, the Rangers got young players, but they also got some decent vets like Zibanejad and Panarin there as well, and they got a good young, obviously young defensive core with Adam Fox, Jacob Trouba. So I think the Rangers come away with the victory in this one.
I'm with the Rangers as well. Shesterkin is kind of the big turning point for me, but also Panarin, Zibanejad, and Kreider up front. You know, mentioned Letang. He had a career high in points this year, which is kind of surprising. I think the Rangers are pretty balanced, though. They got some sleepers as well further down the line with Goodrow, Kopp. I'm not sure what Tyler Motte's going to be doing as well, but I do think the Rangers are the better team here, and I've got the Rangers beating the Penguins as well. Switching over to the West, Dallas and Calgary. What do you think?
I think the Flames take this one. I think, obviously, Markstrom in net, he's been, I don't know. I mean, Shesterkin probably will end up winning the Vezina, but I know early on Markstrom had, what, like 8 shutouts in the first 30 games or something crazy like that. I'm sure he'll be second in Vezina voting, but I think Markstrom's goaltending and just the firepower that the Flames have up front. And also, I mean, to me, the clear Jack Adams winner this year, Daryl Sutter, like that guy deserves the Jack Adams with no question in my mind. I mean, I know there's a couple of guys you can maybe make an argument for, but to me, it's Daryl Sutter's award this year. And I think the coaching, the firepower they have up front, and Markstrom in the back of the net, I think they get it done against Dallas.
Yeah, I agree. I actually think this will be the first series to end. I think Calgary could roll over Dallas in as little as 4 or 5 games. Too much offense, better goaltending, just kind of everything. I think Calgary's a much better team than Dallas, I mean, for all the reasons you mentioned. Plus Goodrow and Tkachuk and Lindholm, 340 goal men as well. And Mangiapane hit 35 as well. Like I think Calgary beats down Dallas a little bit in this series. LA and Edmonton, the other one in our division. What do you think?
I mean, it pains me to say this, but I actually think this could be the series that ends the quickest. And I actually have the Oilers beating the Kings pretty handedly. I think, you know, McDavid and Draisaitl, and even a guy I know he's, you know, he doesn't have a great reputation off the ice. But even the addition of a guy like Evander Kane, like he has made a difference to that team and supplied them with a little bit more depth scoring. Obviously, goaltending is still an issue for the Oilers, and they still have some flaws on the back end. But I think the Kings just getting into the playoffs this year and being a young up-and-coming team is great for them. But I don't think they get past McDavid and Draisaitl. I think McDavid is going to be way too motivated, as is Draisaitl, to kind of try to get on a bit of a run. I think they're going to hit a wall when they play Calgary in the next round. But I've got Edmonton winning this one.
I'm going the other way. I'm going with the Kings. I think this could be actually a longer series, one way or other. I think the Kings actually match up kind of tough for the Oilers, just because they can roll out Kopitar and Deneau one of them, anytime McDavid or Drysdale's on the ice, I think the Kings have the better goaltending. And they do have some depth. I mean, Kopitar is still around. They've got some older guys hanging around the team. I'm also really just cheering for Alex Edler, too. So going a little bit with the heart there as well, kind of like with the Flames, going with the old Canucks a bit. But I'm going with LA in that series. But I think it could be a tight one. Nashville, Colorado. Carolina hasn't jumped conferences yet. What do you think? Nashville and Colorado. This could be a pretty fun one.
Yeah. I mean, I've got the Avs coming away as the victor in this one. I do think it's actually going to be a bit closer than people initially think. I think Nashville is a tough team, and I think they do match up pretty well against the Avs. I think they have the edge in goaltending. You know, Colorado obviously has far more firepower up front, but I mean, the Preds, they're a big team, and you know, they, I think they can kind of grind and wear down and slow down the Avs somewhat, but I do think the Avs come away. I think that just the firepower on the front end, the back end, the only thing holding the Avs back from getting to the Stanley Cup finals, and I think most people's opinion, is their goaltending.
You know, I've kind of gone back and forth with this one too. But I'm going to take Nashville in this series. I don't think Colorado's goaltending is enough to get them there this year. Roman Josi is, and Cale Makar, the two best defensemen, I think, in the league this year, going head-to-head is going to be great. Offensively, they're both fairly balanced. But the thing is, Nashville like led the league in hits and in all sorts of other physical categories. They've been playing playoff hockey for a while. That building in Nashville is going to be loud as well. I think the Preds have a real fighting chance here. So, you know what? I'm going to go with the Preds, but I think it's going to be a rough and tumble series, as is this next one, which I think could be the best of the first round, Minnesota and St. Louis. What are you thinking?
Yeah, I mean, again, I'm glad you actually left this series to be the last to talk about, because I agree with you, Pete. I actually think this will be the most entertaining series in the first round, and I think this is definitely going seven games. And this is the toughest series to call, in my opinion, and I'm sure most people's opinion. But I think it's the Wild. I really do. I've been kind of singing the Wild's praise for about a month now, and I think they're just, you know, seeing them play against the Canucks last few times, they're just a big physical team that has some real high-end talent at the forward position. They got solid goaltending. I think the addition of Marc-Andre Fleury at the trade deadline was a huge win for the Minnesota Wild, and it's, again, this series is going to be a grind, man. It's going to be an absolute grind. But I do think the Wild will come out of it after a hard fought seven game series against the St. Louis Blues.
Yeah, I got the Wild as well. There's just something about watching them and the way they play. I feel like they're also kind of like Nashville. They're a team built for the playoffs. But St. Louis, man, 920 goal scorers or more. That is insane. That's your top three lines, every guy having 20 goals on it. But I do think Minnesota, I think they're a little bit tighter in the back end and a little more physical. St. Louis is a physical team as well, as we've seen. But I'm just kind of going with my gut here. I really think Minnesota and Calgary in the West could be the teams in the conference finals. So I'm going to agree with you, going with Minnesota. Doug, it is time for us to get Sheldon Lee on the line. So let's grab him. All right, joining us this week, we're very happy to welcome into the speakeasy Sheldon Lee, and you can follow him on Twitter, Sheldon G. Lee 1. Sheldon, making your debut on the speakeasy. Welcome, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm excited to be here. Talk some hockey.
Well, there's always plenty to talk about, and I know as well, you know, you had a long night last night working graveyard, getting up, so we really appreciate that, taking a couple hours out of precious sleep to chat Canucks with us.
Oh, my pleasure. I always got time to talk to Canucks, so we're good to go.
Well, we're going to have a lot of time to talk Canucks here, but before we get into that, I always like to kind of get someone's origin story on how you got here, how you got to be a Canucks fan in the first place. So what is your background story with being a Canucks fan?
So I was born in 88. And as far back as I can remember, my dad was, my family for the most part, was world hockey fans, Canucks fans specifically. And I honestly I truly believe that one of my first memories was Pavel Bure's breakaway goal against the Calgary Flames in 1994 during that run. I remember having a bunch of people around me in my house. They were all gathered there. They were all super excited. I wasn't exactly, you know, entirely sure what was going on. But I do remember in overtime when Pavel Bure scored that. And then I remember seeing everybody's reactions around me. There must have been 10, 15 people in my house watching the game with us, and just seeing their reaction, seeing how much it meant to them and how excited it got them. It made me really excited, even though I couldn't fully grasp everything that was going on. But seeing what it meant to them suddenly made me feel like I want to be a part of this too. And that's kind of where I grabbed onto the Canucks and quite frankly, have never let go.
Yeah. I mean, I share a similar story, like the 93-94 run. Like I was a Canuck fan probably a season or two before that, but obviously I got really invested on that 93-94 run, like most of us of our age demographic. And yeah, I mean, that goal that Bure scored, and then obviously, you know, you've got the Kirk McLean save as well in that series. And just, there was just so many of these like iconic moments during the course of that entire run that the Canucks were on that it just, you know, it ingrained itself in my memory, just like you said, Sheldon. And, you know, it just, it's one of the reasons why I love this team. And yet, you know, as much as they disappoint us over and over again, you know, we just keep coming back, man.
Yeah, I agree. 94 was a pinnacle for me as well. Like, I don't remember 82. I was alive for 82, but too young to remember it. So 94 was really, you know, my first kind of playoff taste that I really remember was 89 with the Joel Otto goal off the skate and in. And then to come against Calgary 5 years later and win three straight in overtime. And that Bure goal, I mean, we start off the podcast with that Bure goal. It's still for me, one of the most special moments in Canucks history. And that was just, it was a great era leading to a decline, which is kind of similar to what happened after 2011 as well. But by that point, like, you know, you see a lot of these 2011 fans and how they got hooked by that run. And I think that also, it shows a lot of frustration through those fans. It's like, hey, why can't it be like this every year? It's like, well, you know, those moments are special. Hey, enjoy them when you can.
Yeah, for sure. Agreed.
So this year though, let's, you know, we could dissect everything that's happened in recent memory, but I don't really want to get into that on this episode. I really want to just kind of focus on this year. Cause every Canucks fan knows it's been a struggle the last little while, missing six of the last 7 years of the playoffs, which has never happened before in franchise history. But for all the negatives, there has been some interesting stuff and some really good things that have come out of this year. But just kind of start the conversation, Sheldon. What are some key takeaways or anything that really jumped out for you that you're kind of looking back at from this season?
I mean, it's really crazy to me because I was thinking last night about the beginning of the year as opposed to the end of the year, the first 25 games. And it really was a tale of two seasons. But as I'm thinking back to Travis Green, it's hard for me to even fathom the fact that that was this year. Like, it feels like it was like 2-3 years ago. Just because it was just the change. And I mean, I guess what I take away from everything the most would be, and I'm sure everybody else would as well, the regime change, which had a profound effect on the team, on the fans. You have Bruce, there it is. And I don't know how many, I'm not sure how many fans like myself thought that there would have been that type of a response to a regime change, even though I think a lot of us knew that it needed to happen, and probably took a little longer to happen than it should. But the, I mean, you minus Travis Green and the old regime from this year, and looking forward, the season itself was, I would consider, after Travis Green, was a pretty spectacular success. I think that's pretty hard to deny. It's, for me, I would say the biggest takeaway out of all of that was, I feel like the last 15 to 20 games is the first time I saw this Vancouver Canucks team actually start to look like a team who knew what they wanted to be, where they were going to go, and kind of were starting to figure out how they were going to get there. And it wasn't, I haven't had that kind of feeling probably since 2011, 2012, something like that, you know, a team that actually has an identity. And it seemed like they were and are on their way to kind of finding that, which is nice. It gives the fans hope, which, you know, we haven't had for quite some time. So
I got to say, Sheldon, like, you literally took the take and the words right out of my mouth. Like, I was going to come on here and say, man, this more so than any other season has felt like a tale of two seasons. It has felt like 2-3 years since Travis Green coached this team. Like, these were all the things I had queued up to say myself. And I couldn't agree with you more. Like, honestly, it just, the Jekyll and Hyde from the way the season started and how poorly everybody outside of, I would say, Demko, Miller, and I would say Quinn Hughes, everybody was playing poorly at the beginning of the year. And that change when it was Boudreaux first, and then obviously the change at the top with Rutherford coming in and then him filling out the rest of the management group. You saw that team start to gel, like you said, and really start to kind of play playoff hockey the last, you know, what, month and a half, you know, and they were playing really, really, really well. I mean, I guess the biggest takeaway for me, if I had to pick one outside of everything that you just said, Sheldon, would also be the emergence of Thatcher Demko being an elite goaltender and a guy who can, I know he probably played too many games this year, but he is a guy that can probably play 55 to 60 games, you know, every season. And he's a guy, in my opinion, you know, once this team starts to turn the corner and it really starts to hit its peak, he's a guy who should be and will be in the Vezina conversation at the end of every year, in my opinion.
And he's also on a great deal, which is nice to see as well. I think for me, the takeaway that I look at, I mean, you guys have both already said the tale of two seasons, which 100% it is. And I agree that the Travis Green era and Jim Benning era, it feels like a lifetime ago. It's hard to believe that it was only early December. Like, what is that? Like 5-6 months now away. For me, it was when we went into the season, I think most Canucks fans were looking at the team and myself included, and maybe I was just preaching this a lot, is the Canucks, it felt like had a top nine forward group going into this year. And the question marks were on the blue line, and under Green, the defense was actually better than we thought it was going to be, but the forwards just weren't performing. And everyone was like, this is really weird. Like, it's kind of backwards from what happened. Once Boudreaux came in and the systems changed, the team was exciting to watch. And for me, that was what has really kind of really made the season watchable again, because it was really tough to watch back in October and November. And once Boudreaux came in and changed the systems, the Canucks played more offensively free. They played an offensive first system. The special teams improved. That for me really kind of made things more fun to watch and more exciting. Would you guys agree, like, just that the brand of hockey really kind of changed and became more exciting as the season went on?
100%. The brand of hockey that Bruce Boudreaux introduced to the team was far more exciting. And I also think I didn't quite fully grasp just how unexciting Travis Green was, because there were moments with him where I was like, all right, he's doing what I want this team to do. He's pushing, you know, a more offensive role onto these guys. You know, he has them playing a north-south game, going, you know, just keeping up pace, because that's what you have to do in the NHL these days, right? You can't, slow teams don't matter. They won't go anywhere. You have to be able to skate back and forth. Your legs have to frequently be moving. And it almost surprised me how, because I was quite a staunch Travis Green defender, you know, even towards the bitter end. But it shocked me how much of a difference there was between Bruce Boudreaux and Travis Green. I was a little bit shocked that the difference was as much of a 180 as it was. But the brand of hockey that Boudreaux has introduced to the team, to the city, I think would be pretty hard for anybody to disagree that it's, you know, it's 10 times more enjoyable to watch than it was, you know, a mere 5 months ago.
Yeah, I actually also find it very interesting because Boudreaux's obviously known more as an offensive coach throughout the league and throughout his tenure in the NHL. But yet, I think one of the biggest takeaways for me this year when Boudreaux took over was how much better, and it couldn't have been playing any worse, to be honest, but how much better the penalty killing got once Boudreaux took over, how much more structure and stability the defensive start played, you know, not only the defenseman, but also just the defensive structure of the forwards. And this is a guy who's generally known to be more of an offense kind of run and gun type of coach, but the forward defense got better. The defenseman defense got better. The penalty kill got better. And I guess it's one of those things, you know, that is what almost shocked me more than anything. And not that Travis Green was the staunch, you know, defensive minded Jacques Lemaire kind of coach, because he's not. But, you know, I wouldn't have expected Boudreaux, who's much more known to be a free, open, let the players play. And, you know, if they make mistakes, it is what it is kind of coach. And yet he improved the defensive play of the team as a whole. That kind of shocked me.
One thing that really, really jumps out at me for the Canucks, and, you know, talk about special teams. The Canucks for the whole season ended up having the 30th best penalty killing in the league, 30th. But under Boudreaux, they were 11th. That tells you just how shocking the first couple months of the season was for the penalty kill. There were games where they were allowing 3 goals on 5 kills. The other one, the Canucks finished the season with the 10th best power play percentage in the league. Pretty good. I've got to go through it and see if they're the highest non-playoff team. But under Boudreaux, they were the 2nd best power play. And that surprises me less than the penalty kill, because the Canucks, they're able to put out a skilled 5-man unit, as skilled as I think any other team in the league. But under the old regime, under Green, it was the same systems, the same 2 units going out, it was the same 2 units of penalty killers going out. And then when we started to see everything get shuffled up, it threw teams off. I just think other teams had too easy a read and too easy a scout on the Canucks, because they were just trying the same things for so long. And that goes back to the excitement that we've seen this year. It was just different things. Like, how exciting was it to see Petey and Hughes killing penalties, to see Pods out there late in games? Like, it was exciting to see this.
Yeah. And I'll also say this, and I think this last month, and I know a lot of this had to do with, you know, the Larscheiders, you know, getting a chance to go to the lower bowl. And I know some people don't like that at hockey games, and, you know, each to their own. You know, I get it. Everyone has their own thing. But I will say this. I think the last month or so, even without the Larscheiders being there in the lower bowl, I do really think it was more enjoyable going to a Canuck game. It was actually there was more of an atmosphere. I'd been to a couple of games this past 2 months or so, and they were some of the most enjoyable Canuck games I had been to in years. And I don't know what it was. I don't know if it was just the brand of hockey and the team was more exciting to watch for a full 60 minutes than they had been the past, you know, 4, 5, 6 years. But just the energy level in Rogers Arena, whether it's, you know, being forced, you know, by fans or not, it just felt much better. And it just actually, there just seemed to be more positivity in the building, which I think had been missing for the last, like I said, 8 years or so, essentially under the entire Benning era.
I unfortunately wasn't able to get out to any games this year, which was super disappointing. But I mean, even just by watching it on the television, you could hear it and you could feel the atmosphere right through the screen. And it's pretty impressive. I mean, it all started, I feel like a lot of it started with the Bruce "There It Is" chant, like, give credit where credit's due. Because that was something that really allowed the fans to kind of get themselves involved in the game when we really haven't had any reason or feeling to be involved for, you know, the better part of the last decade. So the city was looking for something to invest themselves in once Bruce Boudreaux got here, once the Bruce "There It Is" chant started. And once we were able to see that this team, you know, was way better than a 31st, 32nd place team, like the first 25 games kind of showed us. Yeah. It was just everybody and everything just took off there, and the fans took it to heart. And yeah, I mean, you really didn't, like I said, I didn't even have to be in the building to see how electric it was. For the most part, since Boudreaux arrived.
And the players could feel that too. And, Doug and I have often joked about how we call Rogers the morgue sometimes, because lower bowl is like half empty, 10 minutes into the first, people are sauntering in. Like the upper bowl is usually pretty good, and that's where we end up. I was in the Lars Scheiders for that lower bowl game. It was one of the best times I've ever had at a Canucks game, just standing the whole game with those guys and gals, and just, you know, that for me, that was fun. That's what I want. And it crept through the building, but even I was at the game before that too, against Dallas, and you could feel the energy in there as well. When you're playing exciting hockey and you got reasons to be excited in the city and you're in a race, the fans get behind you. The problem is that there's been a lot of mediocrity or worse that has really made things tough. And with all that, like Sheldon, on the ice, there was a lot of players who I thought were pleasant surprises and did some pretty amazing things. Who would you say has been the biggest surprise this season?
It's a tough one.
There's quite a few guys. You can all answer multiple. There's no rules here on the Speakeasy.
I'll take two. Tanner Pearson surprised the hell out of me this year. And I was one of the guys who was not overly excited for the contract extension that he got. I thought he would have looked like a perfect piece to have moved at the deadline or something like that for other teams to pick up for their runs. Of course, you know, the season kind of changed after 25 games, and but Tanner Pearson was kind of like the very quiet, just always consistent, and never talked about guy. And I just appreciated what he brought to the ice almost every single night this year, to go along with Luke Shen, who has provided something for this team that I haven't seen in a really long time. At least it feels like a long time. I don't remember the last guy to pretty much stand up to any, I don't know, maybe Ripper is like the first person that comes to mind, but two completely different players, but I mean, the crowd appreciates it too, you know, because we all know that what Luke Shen is bringing to the ice on a day-to-day basis, physicality wise, I mean, you look at the hits that he's piling up on a nightly basis. We just haven't seen enough of that. And it's been so refreshing to see Luke Shen earn that contract. If not even more, I mean, he was worth more than what he provided this team with this year. And Tanner Pearson as well. Well earned his contract, and was the two of them were both just fantastic hockey players for, and I don't know, what do you call that, unsung hero, I suppose, maybe. Yeah. I could give them the kind of unsung hero label, but those would be the two guys who definitely stand out to me the most.
Yeah, I mean, I think both those guys are great. I mean, even I don't even think I still really appreciate how good of a season Tanner Pearson had this year. But I mean, Luke Shen, I mean, I the last guy that comes to mind to me that kind of had that role for the Canucks is maybe an Ed Jovanovski. You know what I mean? Like, he was probably the last guy that would kind of like throw the gloves down if anyone. I mean, obviously there's the other one, you know, which went a little bit too far with Todd Bertuzzi sticking up for a teammate. Mm-hmm. And that's been a criticism of this Canucks team for even going as far back to the 2011 team, you know, when you had Marchand, you know, speed bag in Daniel's head and no one did anything about it. And I think, you know, it's nice to see, and I think it was almost an overcorrection, and I understand why with what happened with Todd Bertuzzi. So obviously we don't want to get into that situation, but yeah, I think that's a great one. The other guy that I would throw out there that I actually think deserves a lot more recognition, especially this year, and I know he doesn't have the best contract, but I actually think he was a very good player for the Canucks. I mean, that's the chaos draft himself, Tyler Myers. I actually think Tyler Myers, and I know, Pete, you're always praising Myers on this podcast.
Not always. I just think he gets a worse rap than he deserves.
You would praise him more than I normally would, but I definitely think Tyler Myers was actually a very serviceable defenseman this year. I mean, to the point where you're hearing he could be traded in the offseason, that there are teams willing to pick up that big ticket contract he has and, you know, add him to the blue line. I mean, and the fact that he's a right shot defenseman, I mean, those are like, you know, such a like rarity. They're like unicorns in the NHL, a right shot defenseman that can play big top 4 minutes. And to me, yeah, I really think Tyler Myers deserves a lot of credit for how well he played this year. Obviously, he's still prone to those glaring mistakes, but he deserves some credit too.
I do wonder how much of that, and I'm sure, you know, a good portion of it was the Bruce Boudreau effect. But I can't disagree with you. Tyler Myers, I don't know how many times over the last two, 3 years, this season, you know, excluded, that I like almost on a daily game by game basis, he would do at least one thing that would just kind of make you say, like, what the hell was that? But I was even thinking this to myself a couple of days ago, sometime last week, maybe. It was just like, I have this year, I have not in my head badmouthed Tyler Myers as much as I have in years past. He has he cleaned up his game in certain aspects, and you know, I'm sure a lot of that is a bit of a Bruce Boudreau effect, but you have to give a lot of credit to Tyler Myers for that too. So I 100% agree with you. That's a good name to throw out there. He had a much improved year for sure.
Well, I just want to touch on those three guys. Essentially, in this market, it all comes down to value above or below cap. Tanner Pearson, I'm with you, Sheldon. I thought it was a very questionable contract when they signed it. I think 3.25 was high. I had him closer to like 2.5. I had nothing against signing Tanner Pearson, but you know, the Canucks need to make every dollar count. I thought going north of 2.75 personally was too high. Yet, I do believe he outperformed that contract. Maybe not by a lot, but you got more value out of it this year than the 3.25. So Tanner Pearson was my vote for unsung hero, just because he really was bringing his lunch pail every day and working and had a fantastic year, I thought, for, you know, chipping in on goals as well. I think he had 14 goals. 14 goals, 34 points, you know, half a point a game player. That's pretty good. Luke Shen, what can you say? Easily playing above his contract value on a league minimum deal. He led the Canucks with 273 hits. The next closest guy had 101 less hits, and that's JT Miller. And I think, you know, you hear about what he brings to the dressing room. You hear about just what the coaches and management are saying about him. He's going to be an interesting one to watch next season as well, how he performs, what the team does with him. It seems like he likes being here. He obviously came back here. Luke Shen, instant fan favorite, kind of doing what Kyle Burrows is doing earlier in the year as well, before Burrows got hit. Tyler Myers. Myers and Shen actually led the team in penalty minutes this year as well. They were the top two. Myers, though, you know, is he worth $6 million? No, he's probably worth about two thirds of that. He's probably closer to like a $4 million player, but he was serviceable out there. Certainly last night against Edmonton, I thought it was one of his poorer games out of him I'd seen in a while. But overall, he was serviceable. And I mean, yes, that's an expensive pairing, and I don't know what the future is with those guys, but he at least got himself back into a realm where the Canucks can do something with him, either on the ice or maybe possibly moving him, or moving him with a retaining salary kind of deal as well. Kind of on the speaking about guys who are performing above value, and I know he's on an entry level deal, so it's a little bit different, of course, but and this is a guy we've talked about throughout the years, Vasily Podkolzin, and how he's gotten better as the season goes on. And we really saw that down the stretch, especially the last month or so of the season. What do you think is the ceiling with this kid? Or what do you see how he fits in with the Canucks long term?
Well, he's a player, a style of player that this team has been longing for quite some time. I don't think he's as big as Jake Virtanen, but I mean, everything that we've seen out of him, all the growth that we've seen out of him from game one to game 82 this year, feels like more growth than we saw from Jake Virtanen in the, you know, 4 or 5 years that he was here. Vasily Podkolzin gets it, and he's a bull. And he seems like somebody who will not stop for anybody. It's either get out of my way or I'm going to go straight through you. And it's that kind of, that is something that has been so sorely needed from this team for so long. What do I see from him going forward? It's hard for me to kind of project some sort of a comparable on him. I find him to be a very unique player. He plays very heavy, but he has a hell of a shot. It looks like his hands look really good. And I think those sorts of things will only get better in time. I don't know where to project him. I really don't. But I do think that he has the potential to be something pretty special for this hockey team. I don't know. Should he turn into some sort of a 60 to 70 point player one year? And I would be thrilled with that. If he's anything better, then let's do it, you know?
Yeah. I think you bring up a good point. Like, he's a hard player to like think of a comparable, because when you think of like a two-way forward, most two-way forwards you think of are centers, right? And he's a winger. So the fact that he is like such a good, you know, defensive player, he's got a great shot, but I also think he's got good playmaking ability. I know we saw like at the World Junior tournament when he played for Russia a few years ago, I think the year he was the captain, he was setting up his teammates who couldn't finish in like multiple, like very positive situations. But the fact that he does play the game, you know, so well on the defensive end, he drives to the net like very few players on this team do. I think the sky's the limit for this guy. Like, I don't think he's ever going to be, you know, a perennial 30 goal scorer or, you know, an 82 point game, 82 point player, you know, essentially a point a game. But I do think he's one of those guys who is going to help this team win, and especially come playoff time. I think he's one of those guys who in a playoff series, he could dominate. He could dominate a series. I mean, you look at like in the past, we see what Ryan Kessler did against the Nashville Predators, Bo Horvat as recently as in the bubble against the St. Louis Blues. You just see these guys that kind of step up and, you know, take over series. And I think he's that kind of caliber of player. He's a guy that you definitely, he might not put up gaudy numbers in the regular season, but come playoff time, he could win a series for you.
I agree with both you guys. He's got a unique skill set, and it's kind of tough to compare him. The fact that he's Russian makes it even tougher, because I think a lot of times when you get a Russian or a European coming over, you're trying to find other Russians to compare him to or other Europeans to compare him to. And there's really no one of that ilk, but he does bring something different to the top six. And I've always said he's not the same player as Tom Wilson, but Tom Wilson brings something different to Washington's top six. And Pod Colson brings kind of some of those skill traits as well. But, you know, and Sheldon, you said he gets it. And I couldn't agree more. He wants to be here. He's showing maturity beyond his years. He's getting the praise of guys like JT Miller and Bruce Boudreaux. One thing that really jumped out to me, and I know a lot of Canucks fans as well, is that he was able to do a press conference the other day. Yeah, we remember Pods at the start of the year could barely speak any English. Like, that just shows he's dedicated himself to really trying to learn the language to fit in. He knows it's going to help his game to be able to converse with his teammates, to understand what's going on more, to be able to get that sort of grasp of a language in that short a period of time. I think it's pretty remarkable.
Quick question for you guys. And again, I this is a Canucks podcast. So we don't want to get into, you know, deep dive in politics or anything like that. But, you know, with a lot of the Russian players in the league who, you know, in the offseason might be going home, you know, what do you think the chances of a lot of these Russian players just staying in North America because of what's going on over there at the moment? Or if some of these players do end up going back home to see some family members, what are the chances of them not being able to get back into North America? You know, does that worry you guys at all?
That was good. Before you finished your sentence, I was going to say, but if they do go back, will they be able to come back here afterwards? I don't know how to answer that. I really don't. It's a whole different world over there right now. And I mean, all I could really say is if I was in their shoes, I don't know. I think it's easy for me to say, because I'm not involved in it, that I wouldn't go back. But yeah. I'm also sitting here on my comfy couch in Canada, and I don't have any relatives over there. I don't have any family over there. So yeah, I can say if I was him, but I'm not. And I'm not in that situation, and I couldn't ever imagine being in that situation. Yeah, I mean, the easy answer is just stay here until things blow over, but I don't really know how easy of an answer that actually is.
I'm more interested to see if teams are discouraging players from going back to Russia. I think that's a bigger thing. Like maybe if they're like, hey, you know, we'd really appreciate it if you didn't go back to Russia this year, you know? So I agree. It's a big political rabbit hole we could fall down here, Doug, but it certainly is going to be interesting. I will be curious to hear where Pod Colson spends the summer. If he stays over here, works out with teammates, learns the language more. I like to think that's kind of where his head is at. We saw a couple of other achievements this year as well with the Canucks. We saw Quinn Hughes break a whole bunch of defensive records, which is really no surprise. And he's probably going to break his own records again. And JT Miller becoming the highest point producing North American player in a season for the Canucks. Just kind of thoughts on those two guys and the years they had, because I know you mentioned earlier, Doug, as well. At the start of the year, those two guys in Demko were like the only ones who were really kind of showing life, it seemed, for a while. So just kind of thoughts on what those two guys accomplished this year.
Quinn Hughes, it's in comparison to last year, there were so many concerns surrounding him, surrounding his size, his ability to keep the puck out of his net. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I believe he went from like a minus 24 to a plus 10 or something like that. And if you prorate last year, whatever that minus 24 could have been, minus 40 or whatever it is, he made a significant step this year. In his own end, on his own side of the puck, he made a significant jump this year. And that, you know, put the points aside, that's not something that I don't think is being talked about enough. He took some flack last year. He took some pretty heavy flack from some people just because he could not get the job done in his own end. And it has been, I'm not going to say a pleasant surprise, but it's been very obvious that he took it to heart. And he went out of his way over the summer and throughout the season to improve that particular aspect of his game, which he did significantly.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I think Quinn Hughes really stepped it up this year in his own end. But I will say this, you know what? And I know he took a lot of flack last year, but imagine Hughes's rookie deal or his entry-level deal was coming up at the end of this year and how much more money he would be making this year. He'd probably be close to, what, $9 million, you know, on his next deal. So in a way, it was probably a really good thing that Hughes struggled last year, because we could be paying he's probably, you know, he could be at least getting, I would say, at least a $1.5 to $2 million raise if he was coming up on a new contract at the end of this year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a fair point. He's a 7.85 deal right now, but he could be well north of nine, considering that's what a guy like Darnell Nurse is getting as well. You nailed it with the stats, minus 24 and plus 10 there, Sheldon. That's exactly the turnaround. The minus 24 is in, I believe, 56 games. So yeah, that could have been closer to minus 40. And you hear all these things about how he took it to heart. Now he said, hey, I'm aware of this. I'm a better defensive player. Even last night, the calmness he has with the puck in his own end is really impressive. His ability to just be sneaky and get away from guys. And of course, Petey can do this too, but I think Hughes really put an emphasis on that. And he did that as well with putting up 68 points from a blue liner. So at least we got him, like Doug, like you said, signed to a reasonable deal. Otherwise he'd be making Doug Lidster money right now. And we couldn't really afford that. JT Miller, though, he just kind of went throughout his business. There were long stretches there where he was the best Canuck, not named Thatcher. I really think from January to March, maybe even October to March, it was the JT Miller show. I think Pettersson really kind of took over a bit more towards the end of the year. I mean, we all know a guy playing above his contract. He's playing well above his contract. I mean, JT Miller is on a $5.25 million deal. He's the fourth highest paid forward on the team. What else can you say about JT Miller and what he brought to the team, guys? Like, just kind of thoughts. I mean, this guy was an absolute beast this year.
Mr. Consistent. And I think the funniest thing about JT Miller to me is how many times I probably traded him in my head this year, you know, like with, like, and how many times I didn't want to trade him at the same time. It's like, no, we need this guy here. We need this guy here. Yeah. But you know, he could get us a whole lot on the trade market. JT Miller was an all-star this year. He was amazing. There's not too much I can put on top of what you just said. I do know that I think a lot of people probably came into this season with, you know, a decent amount of expectations for JT Miller, given how he's performed for this team since he came here. But he definitely exceeded expectations, I think, in every sense of the word. And I think he truly showed himself to be, and there were glimpses of this. I remember the video of him in the locker room during the bubble playoffs, just that intensity and that leadership. But this year it looks a little bit more to me like he's taken on a role where people are really looking up to him, and you know, it's not a captain versus JT, a Bo versus JT thing. It's just him doing his thing, and really standing out. And the points, I mean, the points came because the effort was always there. There are guys who take nights off. It seems like JT Miller, you know, really isn't one of those guys, at least very rarely.
Yeah, I also think like the idea that the narrative that was being spun kind of earlier in the year about like the team is divided, you know, there's the Miller bros and the Horvat hoes or whatever, you know, and again, no, I don't mean it. Like, I don't mean it to like, I'm not trying to be sexist or disrespectful. It was just the first thing that came to my mind. So I do apologize for that. But anyways, I think it actually goes to show that you can have two leaders. And I think there's a psyche with Canuck fans, given what we saw happen when Messier and Linden were here, and that divided the team, divided the locker room. And I think some people were thinking that we might see a similar thing with Bo and Miller, and we didn't. And Miller's comments, I don't know if you guys caught them recently, but there were some comments he put out there saying that he really loves this team. He loves this city. And some of his best friends in the league are on this team at the moment. And obviously, I mean, to him, obviously he's going to want to cash in. I don't blame him for wanting to cash in. Since he's been a Canuck, he has had record year after record year point wise. So, you know, all the power to him, but just that he's also had his career years as a Vancouver Canuck. He's been given a chance to actually play first line minutes, which often in his career, he's never had. In Tampa, he was the third line guy. And with the Rangers, you know, he bounced between the second and third line. And, you know, sometimes he even found himself on the fourth line as he was a young up and coming rookie. And the fact that he's been able to develop into a top line player. And the other thing with Miller that I think is also really intriguing and, you know, similar ish to a Pod Colson, but obviously very different players. It's the utility, the fact that he can play the wing, the fact that he can play center. You don't have too many players in this league that have that kind of utility and could put up the points that Miller does. And then that's what I think makes him a very special player, not only for the Canucks, but to any team that potentially could have him on their roster moving forward.
Yeah, you mentioned center and wingers, also power play, also penalty kill. Also, he hits. He's a power forward. I mean, he is very much a all utility player, brought a lot to this team. We're going to have a lot of time over the summer to dissect what the future of him is with it. But going back as well, the Miller Horvat thing, and we talked about Shannon, how he's a leader in the room. It's like, hey, it's not a bad thing to have a bunch of leaders in the room. That was around a time where the team was really just not playing well. Horvat certainly was a guy who got a really slow start this year and was taking a lot of slack as well. So it is kind of one of those things that sometimes narratives come out or ideas come out that like, hey, this isn't, Horvat's not playing well because Miller is playing well. But no, you can't have too many good leaders. You can have too many leaders, but good leaders. I think Luke Shannon is another one of those good leaders, a guy that we haven't really had that blue line presence since really Chris Tanev. I know a couple other names came up, but that leadership quality was really something that Tanev and Edler both brought, and losing those guys, that really hurt. Sheldon, we're getting close to the end here. I didn't want to look too much forward, so saving this one for the end because it is a forward thinking question. This summer, what would you like to see? I mean, you can be as vague or as specific as you want with this, but what would you like to see happen this summer with the team?
Hmm. You know, I'm always, I mean, I think a lot of the thoughts going into this, and, you know, I hear the gentleman on Sportsnet mention it every once in a while. I think that we're kind of expecting there to be a trade or two of some sort to help relieve some cap, or add, you know, a little bit more depth here or there. What I'm most looking forward to tell you the truth is just to see the plan that this regime has in place. I feel like I haven't been able to see a plan for a decade. I want a plan, and I feel like they actually have sunk their fingers into this. They've had, I don't know how many months now to put good thought into how this offseason should go. But I want to see the new regime put their plan into effect. Even if it's just a start, I don't expect you to flip a team and you know, one year, you know, you got to move things out. You have to have takers. But that would be that is what I'm most excited for, is just to see the new regime kind of take this team and make it their own and improve upon what we did over the last 55 games.
Yeah, I would agree. Like, I think most Canuck fans heading into this offseason just want to see what is the long-term plan of this new regime. And going back to earlier in the episode, Sheldon, and something you had mentioned, and it was about Travis Green and how it seems like a lifetime ago that Travis Green was the coach. And I think part of that was because we saw such a significant change in the on-ice production of the team. But it still doesn't feel like Benning has not been the GM for that long, even though Green technically was fired first and replaced first, because we haven't seen such a significant change to the roster since, you know, this is essentially still Benning's team. You know, the Benning mystique and aura around this team still feels really fresh, at least for me. And maybe you guys would agree, or maybe you wouldn't, as opposed to like the drastic change we saw with Green coming in. So seeing a bit of change, because I know the team played so much better under Boudreau, but I still think there are some glaring flaws in this team. You still need some sort of cap relief so you can go out and make moves and take on bad contracts to acquire more picks or to acquire up and young prospects. And also, like, the big thing for me, and I know, you know, it's easier said than done, I want to see some young right shot defensemen in the pipeline, some guys. And look, I know I still have a little bit of faith in a guy like Jet Wu, but you know, we need to have a lot more young right shot defensemen coming up the pipeline. The left side looks pretty good right now, especially with a guy like Jack Rathbone, but you know, let's really fill out that right side and, you know, get some young prospects in line, because we still need, in my opinion, a long-term defenseman partner for Quinn Hughes.
Yeah, I mean, you guys, I think, hit a lot of things there really well. I agree, this is still very much Benning's team. Out goes Tyler Mott and Travis Hamonic. In comes Travis Dermott and Brad Richardson. Of course, Richardson is UFA at the end of the year. That's really all the tinkering we've seen with the big squad. The new management group has had roughly 5 months, since, you know, 4 to 5 months, depending on when people were brought in, to look at this, creative evaluation process, prospects in the system in general. It's a bit of a weak pool right now, and you need to keep that pipeline going. That's something that, you know, when Benning came in, it was, he's a draft guy, yet we traded a lot of picks away. And here we are at the end of it with a very limiting pipeline. We got to get that going. But I think as well, I'm just curious. I'm with you, Sheldon. I'm curious to see what the vision is here, because we haven't seen it yet. It's been tight-lipped. They've ran with what they got. They've done a little tinkering, as I mentioned. But it's, what is the vision? What is the priority? What do they see here? What do they see with the future of these pending UFAs, the right side? The only questions I don't think they have is in goal right now. What is their vision? And the way they've articulated it throughout the year has been really refreshing as well. I think that's something this fan base was really missing. I mean, we just didn't know what was going on. It was super frustrating. And I think they've articulated it quite well.
Yeah, I agree 100%.
Sheldon, we're going to have to let you go here, but again, I know you worked a graveyard last night, so thanks for getting up here and chatting with us. It was a good time. We really appreciate it.
No, it was my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me. I've listened to this podcast quite a few times, and I'm really happy to be able to get on here and contribute, talk some hockey.
Yeah, man. And again, you know, getting up off the graveyard to come join Pete and I, always appreciated, man. And Pete and I will definitely have to get you back on in the future. And who knows, maybe we'll meet up and have a couple of beers or, you know, a coffee, whatever, you know, in the future as well. We're looking forward to the draft coming up. And obviously, you know, there's a whole season next year as well. So we'll see what lies in the future for us.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, I would. Anytime you guys want to get me on, you can get out, have a drink, all for it. Sounds good. 100%.
Yeah, there's still plenty more hockey to come. We're just going to have to wait 5 months or so for the next meaningful game, I'm afraid. That's Sheldon Lee joining us this week. You can follow him on Twitter at SheldonGLee1. And Sheldon, you're now Canucks Speakeasy alumni, and we will see you soon and do this again.
Sounds good, boys. Thanks so much for having me.
All right, it's that time of the episode for the free pour open floor segment. And I wanted to talk about the NHL playoffs and just how excited I am that the NHL playoffs are back. I know the Canucks didn't make it this year, and it's obviously disappointing being a Canucks fan that the Canucks aren't in it, but playoff hockey is just next level. And, you know, we're seeing it in the NBA as well. But I am just extremely excited about watching playoff hockey. I think, as we discussed earlier in the episode, Pete, there's a lot of intriguing matches heading into this playoffs. And yeah, even though the Canucks won't be there, and I'm super disappointed not to be able to watch a Canucks playoff series or go to a Canucks playoff game this season, I'm just excited to watch playoff hockey. And I'm really hoping next year, maybe even the year after that, the NHL looks at adding the play-in series like the NBA did, because I think it's a huge success, and I think more teams in the playoffs is always a good thing. Let's go playoff hockey.
I'm sure at some point in the summer we can talk about that idea more. We're going to have some time to fill with episodes. For me, I just want to talk about going to London this week. I haven't been on an airplane other than one of the seaplanes to or from Victoria since March of 2020. And on Thursday, I am flying to London, a city that I spent a lot of time with pre-pandemic. I go there a couple times a year. My dad lives there. I got some good friends there. My stepfamily's there. My sister's up in Scotland. I'm going up that way too. I'm doing a quick little jaunt, London, Edinburgh, Glasgow, Dublin, visiting friends and family, cities that I've visited many times over the years that I know quite well. London in particular, though, you know, I've got a part of the tube map tattooed on my arm. It's a city that I'm very close with. I'm only there for a few days, but I'm going to make the most of it, see some friends, hang out, hit some breweries, probably take in a little bit of the sights just from wandering around, but I'm just excited to finally get to be able to go and visit people again and to cross an ocean. And I mean, I love Vancouver, but I want to get out and remind me that there is a bit of a world out there. I've spent the last 2 years exploring the hell out of Vancouver, which is great, but London is calling. Hey, there's another Clash reference right there. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Episode 113 just about in the books. Thanks again to Sheldon Lee for joining us as well. That was a great chat. And Doug, just a couple quick things as we go out here. You're in Toronto. What's the buzz on the Raptors like right now?
Yeah, I mean, heading into that game, I think everyone was really pumped. It was one of the last games of the year for the Leafs in the regular season. I think the Blue Jays were playing, but obviously they went out with a bit of a whimper, which is, you know, I guess disappointing for all the Raptors fans. But I've thought the NBA playoffs have been great as a whole. I mean, the Grizzlies and Ja Morant have been awesome. And yeah, man, it's been a really entertaining NBA playoffs so far.
It has been, and like you mentioned earlier, the play-in series was nice. I've even found myself watching bits of the series here or there. I've been kind of falling out of the NBA a bit and watching more college hoops, but this year it has been exciting. Also, we've had the NFL draft this week. Big trade with the Titans. Anything else catch your eye?
Hollywood Brown also got traded to the Cardinals, Arizona Cardinals, from the Baltimore Ravens. I know Lamar Jackson wasn't too happy about that. He retweeted a comment from a fan being like, what the fuck did we just do? And then I think he tweeted something about what the fuck as well. But I know Hollywood Brown and I believe Kyler Murray played together in college. So that's kind of them reuniting, which is pretty interesting. And then, like you mentioned, A.J. Brown getting traded as well. That was kind of a big name that I don't think a lot of people expected to get traded at the draft.
Yeah, it was interesting doing it in Vegas this year. I missed, at least on day one, all the living room shots. I really liked that during the pandemic, like seeing everyone's living rooms and all that. I know more like day two and three, there's been a bit more of that. But it was kind of, Vegas seems like we're at the right spot for a lot of things sports related. But you know how they have those holding pens out there for all the fans? Man, like just looking at a lot of those fans and the way they react when the cameras are going by, and it's like enough to turn me off the NFL sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's fans in general. It's not necessarily just NFL fans, but yeah, I know what you mean. It's like a camera happens to be in front of them for 2 seconds and they just act like a complete and total moron.
Yeah, we don't need cameras for us to act like total morons over here at the Speakeasy. And you can find us online. I'm at Pete_Gas on Twitter, and do check out our playlist on Spotify, the Canucks Speakeasy Outro Playlist. Give it a listen.
Give me a follow on Twitter at Doug Venn. Be sure to follow the podcast on Twitter at Canucks Speak. As always, thanks for listening.
Hasta luego.